This is tape number 8 of Goblin Hood Satyricon, copyright 1995 by James Theotti, read by Goblin Hood. This tape begins basically on the first page of part 2, called Twilight of the Gob, or Golden Tarantulas, which it begins about halfway down the page. Goblin Hood, who loathed power to begin with, had never wanted to be a ruler, much less the nominal pope of an entire world. Under the circumstances, he could only try to avoid the pitfalls of power, while also trying to live up to his own personal motto, taken right out of Vonnegut's slapstick book: if you can do no good, at least do no harm. A quote from Hippocrates. Like many a despot, he was relieved to leave most of the governing to his colleagues, the Black Widows, who were already respected and feared due to wild rumors about cannibalism, and whom he had no real control over anyway. When he did have to sit in judgment, which was seldom, he tried to preside like Solomon, threatening to cut people's babies in half if they didn't have the sense to just leave him out of it. And then there was the magic, or the psionics, or whatever was going on. But his most primal geish, his most important oath, was the one about being harmless. This pretty effectively precluded his doing anything at all, unless you consider that even not doing anything can be pretty harmful sometimes. And so he was forced to pretty much play it by ear. In any case, he tried to talk his companions and associates out of actually hurting anyone, except for one notable case toward the end of his reign, a case involving not only poetic justice, but quasi-wartime conditions as well. And his reign was, ironically, welcomed as a sort of golden age by the entire continuum, this being the continuum's only inhabited planet. The situation was ironic mostly because practically all of the Gob's subjects had fled to this place from some kind of religious persecution or other form of political or social tyranny. And yet the Gob's regime was inevitable once his ludicrous religion began to spread like wildfire, mostly because of its entertainment value and because it postulated such a pliable and accommodating God. Worshipping Maya was, for most people, just like not having to worship anything at all, except that the rituals were fun and a good way to socialize. Moreover, people erroneously believed that church membership endeared them to goblinhood and thus protected them from the Black Widows, who, very ironically, weren't out to harm anyone in the first place. And yet, harmless or not, there were somehow more Black Widows all the time, all identical, all self-professed cannibals, all equally devoted to their precious Gob, who evidently gave incredible rim jobs or something. There eventually wound up being thousands of black widows, all with funny names, all wearing the same weird getup. Their sheer numbers would have made them a political force to be reckoned with in any case. They had a lot of collective bargaining power to toss around in such a small state. And it was a small state. The Republic, or Protectorate, of Greater Sodom encompassed only a small inhabited area, roughly corresponding to Ohio. The city had evidently been transplanted there for reasons unknown by whoever had created this half-assed dimension. Somewhat mysteriously, nobody ever found out where the Black Widows were coming from. Most people figured them for some kind of goblinhood-esque female clones. All anyone knew for certain was that goblinhood's creator had, once upon a time as a child in Mississippi, actually kept a real Black Widow spider as a pet in a jar, but only for a day or two. The poor thing, which had lost a leg when one of the young lad's relatives captured it for him, soon starved to death because he didn't know what to feed it, though he even tried feeding it bread with ketchup on it, which probably killed the hapless arachnid all the sooner. Then again, that apocryphal sounding little tale may or may not have been a mere parable or something, knowing the gob, but nobody really gave a damn. In any event, the Black Widows became Goblinhood's extended family and his harem, as it were. Fortunately, his reign lasted long enough for him to make it with all of them at least once, since he was equally in love with each of them, and since the existing ones always gave newcomers first crack at him in bed. "Get a load of this," seemed to be the motto of their huge and narcissistic mutual admiration society. And they became his honor guard and the inner party of his worldwide cult, though their only outward sign of this was to each have the Martian harmlessness sigil tattooed on their foreheads under their Black Widow masks for good luck. And the outer cult, which everyone eventually joined just for the hell of it, and out of misplaced fear of the Black Widows, wore masks too, particularly during the gob's public and televised performances of the Maya ritual, which could only be attended by people wearing masks. And it was so absurd watching him perform this act of self-buggery with Maya that nobody wanted to be left out of the fun. The outer cultists, i.e., everyone except G.H. and the B.W.s, wore plain black full-face masks with golden tarantulas painted on the forehead, embodying the yellow, gold, purple Martian H sigil. These hordes of voyeuristic St. Cloudians called themselves Golden Tarantulas in honor of a dream the gob sometimes talked about in which somebody dissolved into a bunch of golden tarantulas during a passionate act of sex. There was even a nightclub, a popular watering spot in the outsider's quarter, which was called the Golden Tarantula. And though the place served any drug or drink anyone could want, the house specialty was a potent brew called a Golden Tarantula, containing, most believed, both ichor and treazenol, among other things. But the Golden Tarantula wasn't actually a business. It was more like a hobby, operated by cult volunteers as a social outlet. Nobody actually worked in Sodom during the Golden Age. Even the famous grocery store where the god had first met Bella Madonna had turned out to be an illusion she'd created to engineer a meeting with him. Barbarossa, however, had been real and had simply gotten sucked into the illusion, much to his amazement. But he later parlayed this legendary first contact into a position of civic leadership in the outsider's quarter. The economic conditions obtaining in this weird place were based upon magic or psionic considerations, unless St. Cloud's affable god was actually real and was just going along with the joke. In any event, nobody had to do anything in Sodom, and most citizens just wound up partying, worshipping, fucking, and indulging in eccentric hobbies, many of which involved the creation of scurrilous but harmless art. Things being what they were, however, and the place being what it was, fucking and drugging were the two main activities indulged in by everyone, chief among them the god, who had thousands of identical lovers to service, in addition to his famed public services of Maya, who had kept the Black Widow's uniform modified only by a replica of Goblin Hood's own mask. Admittedly, the whole shebang wore such a chimerical aspect in general that the gob spent a lot of time suspecting his environment of being a mere glamour in one of the characters in Stephen King's novel It, some unthinkable monster holding him in its slobbering jaws while making him think that he was having a good time. But then the gob himself was basically only a chimera made real, and reality was kind of hard to come by around there. Take that supermarket. What use was it for people capable of psionically creating their own food, except as a place to meet other people in and to have adventures in? Yet Sodom and its environs were full of places like that. The spice of life, in seemingly infinite variety, operated by weird people who waited like trapdoor spiders for someone, maybe even the gob, to wander in so that they, the proprietors, could pounce out and pull some kind of a Barbarossa, no doubt, which presumably made them and their guests happy. There was little else to do where they all were, besides pursue happiness. Actually, the whole place, the entire continuum, was not unlike some gigantic bird dropping that would unfold itself, revealing its secret identity as an exotic Sumatran spider all along, to the first poor, shit-happy insect unfortunate enough to come bumbling along. And damn it, the hell of it was that the place was also a bit like that exotic Amazon fish one sometimes hears about. Once it swims up your dick, there's nothing to do except cut your dick off before your bladder explodes or whatever. It could be said, and with some justification, that the Republic of Greater Sodom was chock full of the damned, full of people desperately copping one last sweet fuck before their bladders exploded. In addition to thousands of Bella Madonna lookalikes, the place attracted weirdos of every stamp and variety, from bizarre existential grotesqueries to outright grubwarts. And the cream of the crap could usually, at one time or another, be seen or otherwise encountered hanging out at the Golden Tarantula, sucking down golden tarantulas, getting shit-faced and holding forth endlessly about all topics, great and small, and even downright stupid. One afternoon, for example, the gob himself ran into the Shogun Squirrel at the Golden Tarantula. The gob, like certain kings of old, was much given to traveling incognito among his people, keeping his ear to the ground whenever he could sneak away from his overprotective army of lovers. The squirrel had just rolled into town and had already gotten a big mad on. It had no idea who the gob was, because the gob was disguised in a simple golden tarantula mask. Nor, in its advanced state of intoxication, could the squirrel distinguish the gob, whom it had only smelled once, from other big cretins by his odor. The squirrel sat slurping up a golden tarantula and bellyaching loudly, not even seeming to care that at least in this continuum it could talk instead of having to type. The problem involved the Shogun Squirrel's sex life.
"Nobody will get it on with me around here," bitched the Shogun Squirrel, "because I'm an animal and because of my tiny organs. Hell, I thought there was supposed to be a sister city or something where they loved to fuck animals, but god damn it." Goblinhood tried to be as reasonable and conciliatory as possible. "Well, just outside the Greater Sodom Protectorate is a forest or something the size of the rest of the world," he pointed out. "There are probably lots of squirrels there."
"Who the hell wants to fuck squirrels?"
snarled his tiny, truculent pal, eyeing the gob as if the gob were an idiot. "Well, geez," stipulated the gob in mufti. "It isn't like you're trapped here or anything."
"The hell it isn't,"
barked the Shogun Squirrel in a peremptory fashion. And that was just it. The squirrel was trapped here. For some reason, entities could get into this continuum, but nobody could get back out. This bothered the gob when he heard of it, and he suddenly remembered his own abortive attempt to escape by bus.
The whole place is just like some kind of a big fucking roach motel,
concluded the irritated rodent. There was nobody else patronizing the bar at that hour, and since it didn't seem worth the effort to beat the gob up, the disgruntled little immigrant contented itself with wallowing in another golden tarantula, as if that might help it to become more gruntled. Watching the obnoxious little bastard sop it up, Goblinhood decided that it was probably a good thing. Nobody would give the Shogun squirrel any action, considering how violently squirrels were wont to hit the ceiling whenever people tried to feed them. Just imagine a squirrel flying off the handle if someone threw it a really good fuck. Meanwhile, this was exactly why the gob liked to go slumming this way. He'd actually learned something really important here, a vital matter of state that he already knew he couldn't do anything about. Barkeep, he yelped, I'll have a few of those golden tarantulas too. Just keep them coming until me and my hirsute companion have forgotten everything we ever thought we knew. And that was about how matters stood at the Golden Tarantula on any given afternoon, or evening, or morning, for that matter. If people weren't there for any other reason, they were there to forget. It was a lot like the French Foreign Legion, except that nobody wore those dippy hats. And the only one, usually, whoever spoke French was the gob, who seldom knew what the fuck he was talking about anyway. C'est magnifique, mais ce n'est pas la guerre, said the gob, who had flunked 3 or 4 years of French in school. Waxing philosophical about everything in general.
Why don't you just shove it up your ass?
Muttered the irate squirrel, wondering who the hell this jerk was. Hey, burbled the gob after a bit. I bet I know how you could get laid. Try wearing this the next time you're on the make. Blearily, he magicked up a tiny golden tarantula mask.
I'll think about it,
cried the squirrel, not liking the looks of the thing. But then, I-Corps operatives were used to going undercover when necessary. If things got bad enough, maybe it would be worth a try. And with that whacked out, ill-considered move, the gob managed to inaugurate a diminutive, dissolute sexual binge which cut a legendary swath throughout the length and breadth of the outsider's quarter. No wonder it's called the Shogun Squirrel became a popular outsider catchphrase of those days. But none of this solved Goblinhood's ever more pressing political, sociological problems as a nominal head of state in what was now seeming more and more like a dimensional prison. And the fact that no adequate solutions seemed to exist only made everything worse. Things could, though, have been worse still. At least the law of harmlessness, apparently a form of gravity, as it were, kept the Shogun squirrel from causing too much trouble, While the small population of this planet made being stuck here less of a disaster than it could have been, but in such dire straits, it was no wonder so many people were turning to some dipshit religious cult to give them a sense of security. The gob often wished that he had a sense like that himself. But that was the curse of great leadership ability. Everyone else, even a fluffy little incorrigible voluptuary like the Shogun squirrel, could bask around smirking about everything, secure in the conviction that the almighty gob would pull as many rabbits out of his hat as might be necessary, little knowing that he spent as much time as he could get away with cringing around in private, wondering what the hell to do, or hiding out in public, trying to climb into a rich, delicious, golden tarantula and simply disappear. "Don't worry, the gob will think of something," said everyone, every time any kind of problem reared its ugly head. Whereas half the time, their fearless leader couldn't even think of his own name or figure out where the hell he was at any given time, or even remember whatever he'd just been talking about, most of which he was just as happy to forget anyway. So maybe ignorance is bliss, after all. Bliss was also the name of a communal wine surrogate. A ceremonial drink they all drank during cult activities, though it was really just like a golden tarantula with some kind of added kick. But the golden tarantulas absorbed this stuff like sponges while attending the gob's Mayanist trysts or watching them on TV at home or at the golden tarantula. Part of the problem in terms of global doom, if that was truly in the portents, was that all those drug-crazed fools hanging around at the Golden Tarantula were themselves part of the problem, if any serious problems were to arise. People stroked out on Bliss et al. Weren't really much help in the clinches. But the big part of the problem was that the gob himself really wasn't in much of a position to do much of anything about anything, one way or the other, without the risk of violating his own prime directive by not being harmless enough. And so he made necessity a virtue by snarling bloodthirsty threats and oaths when nobody was listening. Nobody, that is, except perhaps via telepathy, the Black Widows, who didn't really care what Goblin had said or thought about anything anyway. About making some kind of harmless last stand here in his last-ditch bolt hole if the need ever arose to do anything about anything, since there was no way out anyway. And yet he suspected, intuitively, that, like Spartacus in Kessler's book, he had a chance to sneak out alone if he tried hard enough. But like Spartacus in that book, the gob never truly regarded this as an option, instead feeling obliged to stick it out here with his followers, his fellow weirdos and gutter snipes, even if the very universe should crumble about them. And yet the scariest aspect of this situation was the degree of wandering paranoia induced in the gob by a few bitter remarks obnoxiously ejaculated by a hard-bitten customer like the Shogun Squirrel, who was evidently a raving psychotic anyway, and whose seemingly contagious attitudinal rabies also seemed not to mix all that well with those scrumptious golden tarantulas or even with Bliss. It should have been easy to ignore the squirrel's rantings. So who cared if there was no exit from this dimension? That didn't mean the end of the world was coming, did it? No, it didn't. Or at least not necessarily, anyway. But it should be pointed out that it was sort of the gob's job to care about things like free access in and out of Sodom, at least to whatever extent someone like the gob could care about anything. Nor was it surprising that the gob should attach such apocalyptic significance to the recent news blurted out by the Shogun Squirrel, because goblinhood, an unstable personality to begin with, was so tanked up all the time around here on Treasonal, Ikor, Golden Tarantulas, and Bliss, not to mention more conventional drugs, that his mind, desperately trying to cope with the strain imposed on it by such chronic abuse, was in a constant state of low-grade emergency, which amplified the slightest problem into epic tragedy proportions. Even a hangnail could start to seem like the fifth horseman of the apocalypse. Besides, it was in the gob's nature to look at things that way. In earlier times, the gob's creator, the one who used to be under the mask, had been so depressive as to spend whole days facing every problem and difficulty with the half-sincere, half-conscious wish that the problem at hand, and in fact that all future problems, could be solved efficiently and summarily by the brisk solution of having the earth fall into the sun, or having the sun blow up, or in some way having the entire universe pull some kind of abrupt Saint Cloud. Perhaps this could explain why goblinhood was sort of inclined to sympathize with the late Saint Cloud instead of consigning him to the shameful company of genocidal maniacs like Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and by some accounts, Harry Truman, dropper of atomic bombs and destroyer of entire civilian populations. At least St. Cloud's primary target had been himself. The death of his world had been an unfortunate side effect. The moral of St. Cloud's story was this: it's unwise to live in a world which is controlled, consciously or otherwise, by a mad god, whether of psionic or supernatural stripe. In some ways, St. Cloud had exemplified the essential truth about power, that might really does make right, that having the power to do something more or less justifies doing it, particularly if nobody is left around to complain about it. This natural law pretty much transcends morals and ethics, let alone mundane and oft-expedient human legislation. If a volcano erupts, no laws are applicable. It's called an act of God. Nor do most humans spend much time evaluating the rightness of or wrongness of God's actions. For that matter, the failure of a volcano to erupt at a given time can also be regarded as an act of God, and hence beyond good and evil, except for the views of anybody wishing to make value judgments about such phenomena. In the event that one does wish to draw such conclusions about the activities of volcanoes, here's an example of how such matters can be broken down into moral or ethical terms. During the slave revolt of Spartacus and Company, the freedom fighters are said to have taken refuge on the slopes of Mount Vesuvius, the only active volcano in Italy. According to Kessler, they've encamped in its crater and withstood a siege there. Had Vesuvius been opposed to Spartacus, it could have saved the Romans a great deal of trouble by erupting right about then and blowing Spartacus and all his followers clear off the map. But nary a gibber nor a squeak was heard from the volcano at that critical point in time, implying perhaps that Vesuvius was no fan of slavery. Instead, it fell to Roman generals Crassus and Pompey to destroy the slave army in 71 BC. In fact, Vesuvius could be regarded as a partisan here for having aided and abetted the activities of the Spartacus mob. Unfortunately for the vindictive Crassus, however, Vesuvius was unable to be crucified along the Appian Way with the other survivors of the slaves' forces. Time, of course, passed, and the Roman Empire continued to invade and conquer other nations, to take prisoners of war, and to make those prisoners into slaves. And in fact, this would continue in Rome and elsewhere for almost two millennia. It was only recently, in St. Cloud's time, that his country had abolished slavery. One could, of course, argue here that the power to enslave people made it right for the slavers to do that. Possibly so. But in 79 AD, almost a century and a half after the death of Spartacus in battle, Vesuvius did erupt, killing slaves and their owners alike, burying the towns of Herculaneum, Pompeii, and Stabiae under tons of ash and mud. Perhaps the mountain had finally spoken on the subject of slavery. Perhaps the message was that life wasn't worth living for anybody as long as there were slaves around. So if St. Cloud was simply a type of volcano, then what analogous message, if any, could be inferred from his terminal eruption? Certainly nothing about slavery per se, although St. Cloud tended to regard all existence as a form of slavery. Perhaps his comment was simply concerned with the drug war being waged by his country's government, about the arbitrariness of human law, perhaps even about human hypocrisy. Here is how hypocrisy enters the equation. Treasonal, before it was outlawed, was only one of many harmful substances on the open market where St. Cloud lived, and it barely even existed as a threat compared to alcohol and tobacco. Alcohol, for instance, was a major killer, causing the deaths of those who drank it, as well as innocent deaths out on the highway. Tobacco brought death to its users and was also being linked to illness in non-smokers who were exposed to it. By contrast, treasonal was banned in St. Cloud's area solely because some high school football player or somebody had been foolish enough to think that treasonal could make him a better athlete and had died while overexerting himself on the stuff. St. Cloud felt that the problem could have been resolved by printing a warning on the label to the effect that people shouldn't abuse the drug unless they were going to spend the entire time sitting on their asses the way that he used it. It really wasn't conducive to a lot of physical activity. Or for that matter, the government could have simply outlawed sports. Instead, the legislators chose to outlaw treasonol. Well and good, one might say. They had the power to do that, and they did that. The power and public opinion made what they did right. And besides, they thought they were creating a better world that way. Well and good. Only if they were going to improve the world by legislating people's private behavior, why stop at an isolated incident involving treasonol? Why take it out on treasonol in the first place, when that drug hadn't been known to kill anyone who wasn't using it at the time? What about all the innocent victims being splashed all over America's highways by drunken fools totally out of control on alcohol? And what about the millions of dollars in government subsidies to tobacco farmers, when it had been known for years how dangerous and addictive that drug was? Ironically, in the case of alcohol, the government had tried to abolish the drug with a decade-long experiment called Prohibition. It hadn't worked. Instead, it had encouraged disrespect for the law and led to the growth of enormous criminal organizations. This was because so many people liked alcohol. Their collective idea of a good time was to get so drunk that they didn't know what they were doing anymore and supposedly were no longer responsible for their behavior, which implies in a way that such people didn't really enjoy being alive in the first place. As it happens, St. Cloud wound up taking care of that for them. Anyway, despite alcohol being one of the most destructive recreational drugs around, it wasn't right to abolish it because the government didn't have the power to abolish it. There were too many alcoholics running around, and democracy means that the majority rules, even if the majority are a bunch of drunken assholes. But hardly anybody cared about treasonol. Hardly anybody used it, except for St. Cloud and a few other burnouts. So it was really easy for legislators to take the moral high ground on that score. It just didn't turn out to have been that good of an idea, as things turned out. In the case of tobacco, efforts were being made to ban that, though tobacco subsidies were probably still being paid. And perhaps St. Cloud's addiction to that substance, in the light of those well-intentioned efforts, coupled with his disgust about the double standards involved in all this, was a factor in his final decision to solve everybody's problems by destroying himself and the world besides. For that matter, St. Cloud's world was already being destroyed by the most dangerous and harmful drug of all time, television. At the time of St. Cloud's treasonol crisis, the ozone layer of his planet was falling prey to industry and consumerism, and to hypocrisy and double standards. Many experts blamed the destruction of the ozone layer on the effects of spray cans. These spray cans had been a big deal during St. Cloud's youth. Another miracle breakthrough, the simple puff-puff, whisk-whisk solution to practically any problem. Television advertisements had incessantly yammered about the glories of spray can products, underarm deodorants in particular. As in most advertising, the commercials had stressed the sex appeal of chemically deodorized armpits, which was quite all right, of course, since the commercials had the power to do that. But it was kind of hypocritical, since sex was the most forbidden topic on TV at the time, except subliminally in commercials. At the time of St. Cloud's mass suicide, spray cans were almost as disreputable as cigarette smoking, and the really dangerous ones had all been outlawed. But their damage had long since been done, and television had continued to use sex to sell any products which hadn't yet been outlawed, without the slightest consideration for any negative consequences which might ensue. Television, of course, had played its part in getting Treazenol taken off the market. The death of a young athlete was a sexy news story by TV standards, a hard-hitting action journalism kind of thing. And by making a big stink over Treazenol, the media whores could pretend that they were solving the problems of the world, a placebo effect to lull them while they ignored stories about clandestine operations by their own government in hapless third world countries, and while they continued to promote all kinds of products on the news, including television itself, that were, in fact, destroying the planet. Both television and the rampant consumerism that it brainwashed into its billions of viewers could be regarded as examples of collective drug addiction. Addiction so strong that the drug-crazed participants, subliminally obsessed with sex in the name of commerce, didn't give a rat's fucking ass what happened to the planet's ozone layer or to anything else, just so long as they got their rocks off, or as long as buying a new TV or a worthless car or junk food or any other crap made them feel like they were getting their rocks off. Which it didn't, really. Actually, most media prostitution acted in the opposite fashion. It promised nothing. Instead, it assured the viewer that without this or that product, the viewer didn't stand a chance in hell of getting laid. Affirming, too, that anyone who couldn't get laid wasn't quite human. And everybody bought it. This drug problem was so widespread at the time that an objective observer might be hard put to find any truly innocent victims of St. Cloud's global genocide. But some observers would have tried anyway, had there been any left around to try. And they might have tried St. Cloud as a war criminal of the drug war, had he still been around to try. Which is another interesting aspect of how might can make right, of how power can be its own excuse. War crimes are invariably defined by the victors in war. Treazenol had fallen prey to public opinion, egged on by a media which cared about nothing but its own ratings, but which pretended that it was dedicated to making a better world. But in Germany, circa 1933, public opinion and the media of the time allowed Adolf Hitler to try building a better world by passing laws which effectively made it illegal to be Jewish. It was the law of the land, and 6 million Jews were duly exterminated in accordance with that law. Hitler had the power to do that, but he didn't have the power to make it stick, because he didn't have the power to win the Second World War. Following the war, Hitler's entire government, the people who had so pleased public opinion by carrying out his laws, were put on trial for war crimes and for crimes against humanity. An international tribunal expedited this with the idea that a substantial body of international laws superseded national laws and forbade, for example, the massacre of hapless civilian populations. Critics of this process characterized the trials as the vengeance of victors or as an exercise in power politics. But public opinion held sway, as it always does, and it always has the power to do, as it always has the power to do. Most of the losers in that war were hanged, imprisoned, or otherwise penalized for the decisions of their governments. Those who weren't co-opted for the next war, that is. Of course, the tribunal's decisions were right, because the tribunal had the power to make and to enforce those decisions. And they would have been right anyway, if only for ridding the world of monsters like Ernst Kaltenbrunner, whose vicious activities resulted in the murder of thousands of his country's enemies in a single day's time. But it's interesting to note that one participant in this judicial process was President Harry Truman, whose orders had caused atomic bombs to be dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, causing, in a matter of minutes, the destruction of well over 100,000 of his Japanese enemies, civilians though they were, let alone untold masses of future civilians genetically damaged by the bombs. Truman had the right to participate in these proceedings because he had the power to participate. And so he did participate. There weren't any Japanese participants, by the way, at least not on that side of the proceedings. That was what they got for losing the war. A cynical outlook, all this, to be sure. But Raymond St. Cloud had been nothing if not cynical. In any case, speaking very cynically, it could be argued that St. Cloud's war crime wasn't truly his fault, because the balance of his mind had been disturbed at the time by drugs, by the non-stop cultural frothings of television, by his own fucking insanity, by you name it. Goblinhood was also pretty cynical by nature, which made his present position of relative power a very uncomfortable spot to be stuck in. The most crucial difference between St. Cloud and Goblinhood was the harmlessness factor, so pervasive in Goblinhood's self-taught philosophy. And though it had been articulated from something in a book by Vonnegut, the idea itself had had a sort of interesting genesis. Goblinhood's creator had originally had some rather strange ideas about art, ideas entangled with the concept of sympathetic magic. He'd gotten the idea from art history classes in college that cave paintings, for instance, were a primitive effort to psionically control nature through magic. Paintings of animals, for instance, were meant to ensure a good hunt. In a strange way, these ideas connected up with another idea learned by the artist during his sporadic indoctrination into fundamentalist Christianity, that in terms of sin, the thought is as bad as the deed. This notion takes on incredible significance when applied to the death of the artist's mother. Because of his mother's death, the artist had perforce become a student of power in general, and of psionic power in particular. Gradually, he developed an aversion to power and to the idea of hurting anybody or of causing the world any harm. This feeling became important during the notorious Marcion affair of the late 1980s, when the artist's involvement with the Lovecraftian entity Nurgle had put the entire world at risk by giving the Marcion Zoni access to the artist's mind, a powerful psionic weapon, perhaps capable of world destruction. Ironically, it was the artist's love for individual people and, most ironic of all, his sheer love for painting, which had saved the world on that occasion. Goblinhood's creator had gotten into a dilemma quite apart from the Marcion psychic invasion, which he wasn't, strictly speaking, even aware of. The dilemma that he was aware of was this. He'd started an epic painting called Millennium. The theme of the painting was a critique of humanity's collective spiritual aspirations. Every human effort to achieve utopia, suggested the painting, was preceded by and built upon the ruins of some kind of bloodbath, as witness Hitler's thousand-year German Reich, the ultimate dystopia masquerading as an anti-Semitic utopia. Here was the artist's problem. To demonstrate this idea, he had to paint dozens of scenes of violent death from photographic evidence, historic proofs which illustrated his concept perfectly. By this time, however, he reached the point of being afraid that painting such pictures would actually cause people to really die. And, judging by the fiasco involving his mother, he figured the victims would probably turn out to be people that he really cared about, perhaps during a time when he temporarily lost his temper toward them or something. He'd learned to view the psionic force as essentially poisonous in nature, perhaps simply due to the well-known corruption of power. And with Nurgle breathing down his neck, of course, the force was pretty poisonous at that, or at least potentially so. It was a crackpot idea, perhaps, but then he was a crackpot artist, so what can anyone expect? The artist's final solution to this problem was another crackpot idea, born of desperation, an idea so crazy that it just might work, as they say. He resolved his insane dilemma by embracing his insanity and running with it. First, he created a symbol of his power, the Marcion sigil, that later wound up on Goblinhood's mask. With this act, he accepted the power entirely, for the very first time. Then he used this vast, world-shattering power to guarantee that everything he did from then on, especially everything psionic that he did, would be completely harmless, thus leaving him free to paint with impunity. It was an elegant solution, however psychotic it may also have been. He reasoned that if he could do anything with the power, then he could also do that, effectively negating the power. Of course, he couldn't make the power go away according to the laws of paradox. The power had to be there in the first place in order to negate itself, or it would have been right back there anyway. But he could and did invest the sigil with the ability and the mandate to negate the power on an ongoing basis. This little scheme didn't work perfectly, as he found out the next time he tried to do anything psionic, which turned out just as disastrously as ever. So he abandoned his psionic endeavors, except where they involved travel between dimensions. It also developed that almost nothing is really harmless in everybody's eyes. After all, the Romans didn't think Vesuvius was harmless when it helped Spartacus to defy them. The Germans, more to the point, were being harmless when they sat around with their thumbs up their asses while Hitler created his Nazi regime, even though most of them did nothing at all. But at least Goblinhood's creator was constantly thinking about being harmless and trying to find ways of actually being harmless, which is more than, say, Cloud ever managed to do, and which is, in fact, more than most people ever managed to do. The most significant result of this episode was that it prevented the Martian invader from using the artist's mind to destroy the artist's world, thus, ironically, making the artist sort of responsible for all the misery of that world's bleak future. You just can't win, psionically or otherwise. Still, it was fitting, perhaps, that the solution to a mental problem partially engendered by the tenets of Christianity should be itself derived from Christianity, because the whole idea of trying to be harmless was simply a variation of the golden rule ascribed to Christ. Only this variation would probably be articulated thusly: do unto others nothing that isn't harmless, and don't do anything either, unless that looks to be harmless. In most cases, of course, you're damned if you do, and also damned if you don't. Strictly speaking, in other words, the whole harmlessness trip was an existential quagmire, and now, in the wake of his creator, Goblinhood had inherited that quagmire, which affected all his attitudes and his dealings with the world around him. So it's little wonder that his viewpoint was essentially so apocalyptic. The end of the world sounded like a milk run compared to hanging around, barging around, trying to be harmless about everything. Of course, it helped that harmlessness was almost a natural law in Sodom. That especially helped if the environment was going to contain a walking disaster area like the Shogun's squirrel, for whom harmlessness wasn't even a concept, let alone a way of life. the squirrel's idea of being harmless, especially when it was twisted on drugs, was to not kill somebody who'd been dumb enough to feed it, but only to maim that person for life instead. Yes, the Shogun squirrel was a tough nut to crack, whose very presence alone tended to inspire the gob with intimations of impending doom and apocalypse. And not even Bliss could manage to soothe the savage breast of that savage little beast. But here's what Bliss could do. Every time the gob and his stuffed paramour made the Rose of Sodom together, all the blissed-out acolytes actually believed that he was performing some kind of protective spell, instead of just getting his rocks off and showing off in front of the Black Widows. And every loyal golden tarantula held this delusion as an article of faith. The whole thing had a kind of Martian flavor to it that sort of titillated people in an unspecified way. Better still, the gob's act made people tend to look upon their own sex lives, however miserable, as a species of milk run, to say nothing of their spiritual lives. The cultists saw God as a sort of King Kong figure demanding sacrifice, represented here by Maya, with the gob doing a really grotesque impression of Fay Wray. And yet for him, it represented true communion. Each sacrifice led to yet another miracle of transubstantiation as he watched himself in the double mirrors, actually becoming the thing that he worshipped in the St. Cloudian sense. And even though Maya's face was starting to tear loose from the stress, let alone whatever damage this was doing to the gob's battered rectum, apart from these matters, the whole thing was otherwise perfectly harmless. It was like the long version of a slow-motion martyrdom. And even though his recurrent sacrifice couldn't really help anyone, it really did have a great placebo effect on the Black Widows and the Golden Tarantulas, especially under the influence of Bliss. Besides, with Maya wearing a copy of his own mask, Goblinhood became, most likely, the only despot in recorded history who could or would go fuck himself for the edification of his subjects, and without even having to be asked or told. And of course, what the pure-hearted, spider-faced sodomites were doing was only the merest symbolic bowdlerization of what real spiders were up to. Black widows sometimes eating their mates after sex, real tarantulas having to virtually fight to the death to procreate, with the male trying to paralyze and rape the female before she could kill him. A great bunch of guys and gals they were down yonder in the spider realm, which had been around for countless millennia. Not to mention the so-called tarantula hawk wasp, which liked to paralyze spiders and lay her eggs in them so that the newly hatched babies could eat the spiders, thus paying them back for countless millennia of their own cruelty, the cruel practice of catching bugs and slowly drinking them alive. And for countless millennia, nature had meandered along in this fashion, with rape being the normal genesis of existence itself. How strange, then, that the impulse had been left behind by the human species, at least in this time and place. The law of harmlessness precluded rape in these environs. Hence the absence of children and most animals as sex partners. Even what could be construed as rape was impossible, which sounds impossible given human nature, but it's the nature of magic under discussion here. The only victims possible to a potential rapist were people who wanted to be raped, itself a contradiction in terms, or rather people who liked playing at it, who thought the idea that was exciting and sexually stimulating. But true rape requires the true resistance of the victim, and that couldn't happen around here, because only nominally consensual impulses were allowed to come to fruition under the prevailing conditions. Otherwise, the entire gaze of being harmless would have broken down under the weight of its own illogic, which smacked naturally of some kind of mind control. Deplorable, of course, but you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, and eggs like rape were made to be broken. In the gob's opinion, whenever he considered the matter, in fact, whenever he considered the matter, it seemed incredible that humans had ever evolved beyond that blind procreation-inspired urge to wield power over others. Most humans, anyway, regarding the very idea of rape with ultimate horror, the gob also regarded the transcendence of it as being one of humanity's finest achievements. Too bad, of course, about all the poor suffering monsters whose only pleasure could be derived from that sense of power attendant upon the violation of others. The gob, however, would cheerfully have boiled such people in oil, though deriving no pleasure himself from their violation and fatal torment. He would also have regarded their demise as necessary weeding of the gene pool. Once upon a time, perhaps, the urge to sexual dominance had probably been a survival trait for the entire species. If everyone had waited around to be invited into bed, the race might have died out. Tarantulas, for instance, in similar circumstances, would never have been invited, meaning that there wouldn't be any tarantulas around today, if that matters. But evolution is famous for discarding survival traits that no longer work. With the advent of the massive human brain and its capacity for intelligence, the evolutionary need to act like spiders in order to keep the species going had become obsolete. These days, women could largely control procreation themselves, aborting any fetuses which they didn't want to bear, and even implanting others through artificial insemination without any direct involvement with males at all. And since women were still the only humans capable of actually bearing children, it stood to reason that what they did with their bodies should fall solely under their jurisdiction, assuming that the species really wanted to survive, that is, and not destroy itself in a pointless struggle to mindlessly preserve outdated attitudes. After all, even if the last man on Earth did manage to impregnate the last woman on Earth by force, in order to perpetuate the species, She could still, if she chose, thwart his plans by killing herself and the future of humanity with her, whereas a female tarantula wouldn't have been smart enough or self-aware enough to figure this out, to realize how little point there is in perpetuating a species whose only wish was to enslave her to that end. This change in outlook had evolved, albeit slowly and very sluggishly, in order that the species could continue to get along with itself, since evolution had seen fit to bestow intelligence upon women rather than letting them evolve as the brainless sex slaves of their male counterparts. It was analogous to toilet training in evolutionary terms, the desire in males to spill their seed wherever and whenever they chose to was a lot like the desire in infants to void the contents of their bowels wherever and however they felt like doing so. In both cases, social harmony could only be maintained by having everybody learn self-discipline and self-restraint, by having everybody learn to do such things only at the appropriate places and times. The mystique of the dominant male dragging some brutalized female back to the cave to violently teach her what she wanted, which inevitably turned out to be cooking, cleaning, childbearing, and child-rearing, and any kind of shit work at all. This violent, patriarchal mystique, supported by self-interested crap like the Bible, had left in the Gob's home con anyway, had led in the Gob's home con anyway, to a glaring gender schism, bordering at times on civil war, and to the weird phenomenon of more than half the human race being treated like second-class citizens at best. In all fairness, many religions had, in fact, exalted this unequal state of affairs, not just Bible-related ones. But now the apotheosis of the so-called alpha male was at an end, in these parts anyway. Men could still be men, of course, but they couldn't push anyone around who didn't want to be pushed around, which some people actually honestly did. And for that matter, the same went for overly aggressive women. They could only connect with naturally wimpy partners. Hence, all the sadists and masochists had to be pretty upfront about their transactions with one another, or with anyone. In all, it was a very upfront sort of society for a bunch of people and a squirrel who all ran around wearing masks all the time. Yet this law wasn't observed by people obstreperously filling out some kind of political correctness questionnaire or something as a prelude to sex. Like all magic, it just happened to work out that way, thus preserving the integrity of the geish. Here's how it worked. Take the Shogun squirrel as an example. Apart from its egregious personality, only a lunatic would want to fuck around with so violently volatile a creature at all, much less in bed. Well, there were plenty of lunatics around at that. But the squirrel was a classic example of a rapist-type mentality. Divide, conquer, rape everything in sight to death, then rape all the corpses, especially in the squirrel's deplorable case. After being treated to a good meal by some hapless, deranged fool. Here in Sodom, however, despite any amount of virile, self-righteous chest beating, the creepy little prick was automatically, by magic, restricted only to those partners who actually wanted to go to bed with such a creepy little prick, of which there were apparently many, there being no accounting for tastes, even here. As for what they did in bed, most of humanity has, very fortunately, evolved well past the point of wanting to know anything about such tawdry matters. As previously noted, of course, the whole thing amounted to a kind of benevolent and all-pervasive mind control imposed on everyone by the environment itself. But at least it kept Goblinhood and his governmental cohorts from having to boil anybody in oil. Anybody, that is, who didn't actually want to be so boiled. It would have been nice, or so it often seemed, if dignitaries like the Shogun Squirrel could have developed and expressed such a weird hankering. As to ethics, particularly those surrounding the concept of free will, it must be remembered that everyone was here in Sodom by choice. If their choices were then limited to harmless ones, well, contrasted to that malicious little game played by the great god Yahweh in the Garden of Eden, with creatures whose choices about most things had never even been considered. Adam, for example, though told to choose names for animals and whatever, had never been asked if he even wanted to be alive, much less if he wanted to deal with Yahweh's sleazy little dick tease scam regarding the forbidden tree. So which form of tyranny was truly more ethical? For that matter, how ethical is the law of gravity, and how much free will does it provide for someone who happens to be falling out of an airplane? On close examination, of course, the whole idea of harmlessness becomes pretty ridiculous, thus hitting close to the norm as far as Goblinhood was concerned. Life forms have to consume each other to survive, each being consumed more or less against its will. Even poor, hapless disease germs have to bite the bag every time some sick entity becomes healthy again. Life is one long act of mayhem being perpetrated on the world by itself. Hence, whatever kind of occult gaze obtained there in Sodom was necessarily subject to what could be called the principle of limited application, or perhaps the law of relative function. A classical example would be the old Greek myth of King Midas. In this tale from Ovid, a stupid king, Midas, did a favor for Bacchus, the god of wine. Offered the granting of any wish, Midas asked that whatever he touched would turn to gold. Had he been a wino instead of a greedy monarch, he might have asked Bacchus to make it rain muscatel, which would have endeared him even further to the divine tippler, no doubt. Anyway, the wish was granted, but Midas had to ask for it to be undone once he discovered that he could no longer eat, because even food turned to precious metal in his hand. Obviously, though, the Dionysian magic of Bacchus was controlled in terms of limited application, whether Ovid saw fit to say so or not. Otherwise, the ground, the entire earth, would have turned to gold beneath the monarch's feet. Worse yet, without some provision for relative function, the very air in contact with Midas all over would have turned to gold the minute the spell went into effect, a bit like Vonnegut's mythical Ice Nine. Talk about a golden age. Fortunately, the old gods seemed to know their stuff. Of all the old gods, for some reason, Goblinhood's favorite had always been Loki, the old Norse god of mischief. As it happens, the gob's creator and former self had first learned about Loki and Midas at the same time, as a child, reading a child's book of mythology. The main tale of Loki had been vaguely titillating, even to the artist's childish mind, because of the transvestitism involved. In this yarn, Loki was relatively benign and was sort of a playful sidekick to the thunder god, Thor. Thor, though generally pretty dour and humorless, seemed to have let his hair down a little bit when he played Batman and Robin with Loki. The two pals went to Jotunheim or somewhere to a feast being given among giants. The giants had stolen some Asgardian apples or something, or in some such way pissed the gods off. To infiltrate the banquet, Thor and Loki had to be dressed as women, or be recognized for the puny Aesir that they were. Actually, Loki was only sort of half Aesir in some tales. Once things got down to cases, of course, Thor was quick to reassert his regularly scheduled booming manhood and to really let his hair down too, in his favorite way, cheerfully splashing giant brains all over the castle walls with his famous hammer. A real party animal, that Thor. But one pictures Loki still in drag, off giggling effeminately in the background somewhere. As a devotee of hardcore St. Cloudism, obviously Goblinhood was the ultimate sexual transvestite. Even the mask was a form of drag, except that Goblinhood, instead of wanting to be pretty, apparently wanted to be pretty ugly for some obscure reason of his own. And this was doubtless one of his greater successes. Other stories about Loki had the mischief maker engaging in eating contests and the like, and in playing pranks. But some of the pranks were pretty nasty, most notably the one where Loki manipulated Hodur, Baldur's blind brother, into killing Baldur with mistletoe. Although it could be argued that Loki was acting as an agent of divine retribution, if such a term means anything among gods. Frigga, Baldur's mother, had exacted a promise not to kill Baldur from everything in creation, everything except mistletoe, which she either overlooked in her absurd mission or, according to one account, ignored because of the plant's insignificance. All this had started because Baldur was having bad dreams about being killed, but now, with his newfound invulnerability, he played a game with the other gods. They'd throw things at him and try to kill him, and he'd stand around smirking and not being killed. It was great fun. The gods all loved Baldur, and they loved trying to kill him, too, for some asinine reason. But Baldur and his cronies were all guilty of the ancient Greek sin of hubris, a sin of pride, sometimes defined as reaching too far and offending the gods. It's also analogous to tempting fate, particularly in this case. And so when Loki guided Hodur's hand so that he, though blind, could join in the fun and throw some deadly mistletoe at his brother, it's quite possible that Loki's hand was being guided as well. For that matter, Odin, father of Baldur and boss of all the Aesir, knew that Baldur was going to die, but let the stupid game take place anyway, which isn't really very surprising considering how gloomy and stoic this mythology was to begin with. The gods were all just waiting around for Ragnarok anyway, so that they could all be killed. They knew that was going to happen, too, but they were all too busy sitting around drinking mead and berserking and whatnot to try and prevent it. Not that any of this is all that mitigating. Apart from his motives here, Loki's normal behavior virtually personified the sin of hubris. L. Sprague de Camp and Fletcher Pratt once wrote a science fiction fantasy story about the Norse gods, which can be found in The Complete Enchanter, Ballantine Books, 1975, in which they called Loki Uncle Fox and quoted from a presumably real lay about him, the Locasenna. I say to the gods and the sons of gods, the things that whet my thoughts. By the wells of the world, there is none with the might to make me do his will. Which pretty much says it all, hubris-wise. Another science fiction writer, Lester Del Rey, wrote a similar novel in 1959 called Day of the Giants, in which Loki was called the evil companion by the other gods, but was portrayed sympathetically and characterized as being friendly to humans. Not unlike Prometheus, except that Prometheus